First order of business is a public hearing on 2067. John, do you have a little summary?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that has a very simple purpose, and that is to stagger the terms of the members of the State Board of Aviation. There have been times in the past when they've experienced a loss of experience on the board because a predominantly large number of the board members have left the board over a short period of time, and so staggering the terms would make it easier for them to retain experience on the board.
And do we have anyone signed up?
He didn't sign up.
Hugely better.
Okay, Charlie, I think we're ready for you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Reardon, Acting Director with the Oregon Department of Aviation. I have prepared a short written testimony that I've distributed, and the Oregon Department of Aviation does support the House Bill 2067. It does provide for a staggered terms for the members of the State Aviation Board. The staggered terms of the State Aviation Board members will allow a greater level of continuity to exist during the transitional time period that occurs during the process of appointing new members to the Oregon Department of Aviation Board. With our Board of Directors right now, what we have is they're appointed for 4 years and it expires. They all expire at the same time, and by staggering these terms, it will give us a better continuity with the different members on the board, and it will help us maintain our long-term visions for the department.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, am I correct in understanding it does not change the size of the board, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, that is correct. There will be 7 members.
I think you have 3 new board members that are all elected or appointed by the governor for 4 terms. You don't propose to change those terms. It's just the new people you bring on. Is that how? I want to know the mechanism you have in mind, Charlie.
The mechanism is that they will be staggered terms. So the 7 members, there will be 1 member appointed for 1 year, 2 members appointed for 2 years, 2 members appointed for 3 years, and 2 members appointed for 4 years. After the passage of this, the governor will select which member on the board will be assigned to that slot, and it will begin from that time period. Okay. Mr.
Very
Chairman.
Good. Thank you. There's no further questions. Thank you very much. And any other persons interested in testifying on this bill? Close the hearing and open a work session on 2067.
Mr. Chairman, see if I can get this right. I move that the committee pass with a do pass recommendation House Bill 2067.
To the floor.
Thank you.
Representative Burley moves that we pass 3067 to the floor with a do pass 2067. To the floor with a do pass recommendation. We'll practice a little bit. And we'll get better at this, I hope. Any discussion? Mike, do you want to call the roll?
Representative Boone?
Yes.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Hurley?
Yes.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
Yes.
Chair Gilman?
Yes. And Representative Thatcher, would you be interested in carrying this bill on the floor?
Sure.
That was enthusiastic.
Yes. I don't think I like it.
It will be your first one.
It's just too complicated.
I know. Okay. Now, I'll open a hearing on 2068. And Charlie, we're ready for you again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name again is Charlie Reardon, Oregon Department of Aviation. I prepared another written overview of the House Bill 2068, and what 2068 is, it changes the language depicted in ORS 837.005, 837.040, 837.045, 060, and 990. The changes not only make the language current to today's times, they also clearly express the requirements of the Oregon Department of Aviation in maintaining compliance with the state aircraft registration process. Some of the language is old, and I've outlined some of them. One of them in the existing language specifies that aircraft physically capable of operating our flight as determined by the director of the Department of Aviation. I think it's quite a challenge to get the director to say that an aircraft is airworthy and safe for flight. So another one, as an example, an application for the registration of an aircraft duly signed by the owner on a blank or blanks to be supplied by the departments for such purposes is confusing for the people that own aircraft and need to register them in the state. So we have provided new language for House Bill 2068 to make it more easily to understand the requirements to register your aircraft in the state of Oregon.
Questions? I understood there were some amendments to this.
Mr. Chair, yes, and members of the committee. Originally, there were some civil penalties included in this House Bill 2068. Civil penalties included a $500 fine for those that do not register their aircraft. With some fiscal analysis, we think that approximately the FAA, the difference between what the FAA says of the aircraft registered in the state and what we have registered in the state is a difference of 3,000 aircraft that may not be registered. We felt that if we added a civil penalty, that would put some teeth in the mechanism and allow some of those revenues to be captured by causing those people to register their aircraft who currently don't register their aircraft. The resulting difference between the people that register their aircraft and the penalties, the penalty phase of it, we calculated finances calculated that would be about $179,000 in a biennium period. We wanted to remove that, and because of the changes in leadership in our office, and the intent is good. Sometime down the road, we would like to pursue it further. However, if you look at capturing $179,000 based on a $500 fee, that would be approximately 15 aircraft a week that somebody from our office would have to go out and find. Now, the question is, who is that staff member that's going to go out to these airports and find those aircraft? A second challenge is if you go to the Newport Airport, are the airport manager in the city of Newport going to allow a state official to come onto your airport and look for aircraft aircraft that are based in the state but not necessarily registered in the state. And on top of that, some of those aircraft may be in hangars. Who's the state official that's going to go open up a hangar door and look inside a hangar to find out if that aircraft is actually registered? So at this time, we felt that it was not prudent for us to even attempt to go forward with that until we dig into it further and come up with a better program to proceed with that.
Thank you. Now, questions?
Thank you. Your testimony says that the state registration is not a certificate of airworthiness. Is it the federal government license that is a certificate of airworthiness?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, yes, sir, that is correct. The Federal Aviation Administration issues an airworthiness certificate for each aircraft. We do not do that.
Thank you. So this in no way affects any of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that's correct. This does not affect the airworthiness certificate at all.
Okay, thank you.
Because we do not have the amendment, do we have the amendments?
I believe you do.
Even though we have the amendments, I don't intend to work this bill today. I want to give you time to think about it before we go ahead and work it. So is there any further questions?
Yeah. The only question I have, kind of looking at it more globally, have you talked at all with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining? Obviously, you know, one of the real passions of a lot of us is looking at streamlining regulations, and there's this whole state government-wide effort to streamline regulations, not add new ones that aren't necessary, but to obviously to move forward with ones that are critically necessary. Have you had consultation with that office as part of this process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, no, we have not. With the current people in our office, we have not. Prior to the current staff in our office, possibly they had. I don't know if they had or had not, but the current staff working with the Oregon Department of Aviation has not had any consultation with that department.
Mr. Chair, perhaps you could ask either our staff or the department to just check that box and make sure we're okay there.
Sure. Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Well, I just note on Section A where you clarified that it's capable of flight, but not according to the Oregon Department of Aviation anymore or the director. Do you think there might be situations where people just have some planes in their hangar, don't really fly them? Would there be a different category of registration for those that are capable of flight, but they're just sitting, you know, around collecting as collector's items? I just wondered if that's...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, there is the process. A lot of aircraft are in the state of mechanical overhauls. They are broken, and you know, the people have run out of money to fix them, or time, energy, and effort to maintain those aircraft, and they either go out of annual, and if an aircraft does not have an annual certification by a mechanic who issues that, so the aircraft is probably not airworthy unless it has been issued an airworthy a current annual. Without that, it is not in an airworthiness. It does not have an airworthiness certificate. So they typically call our office and pose those questions. And if it's not airworthy, we don't register that aircraft.
Would maybe a better choice of words being say that the civil aircraft is registered as airworthy rather than capable of flight? Because that's two different things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think that we could look at that and address that to make it more appropriate.
And I have one more question. What exactly do the fees support? Does it just support the entire air system or airport system in the state? Does it go to anything else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I believe that the funds from pilot registration and aircraft registration go for flight safety. May I ask someone else that question? Where did the funds go?
Why don't you come forward and state your name and get on the record?
Thanks, Charlie. My name is Jennifer Keller. I'm the fiscal manager for Department of Aviation. Chairman Gilman and committee members, the pilot registration fees goes, that money is budgeted through the Department of Aviation budget, but the money itself is dedicated for search and rescue efforts. Typically in past sessions, that has been budgeted through Oregon State Police. That changes this biennium in this budget request to Homeland Security. They've changed that, but that money is dedicated for that. Aircraft registration fees, that money is dedicated to the operations aspect for Department of Aviation.
Further questions?
Clarifying, that means people who run the towers and operate the state airports. Is that what you mean by operations? Or is it just for the department?
The Department of Aviation's operations section itself, not the tower operators.
Further questions?
Follow-up. Maybe I misunderstood, but did I understand you to say that if an aircraft is not airworthy, you don't require it to be registered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I think that is correct. If I had an aircraft that had the wings off of it and it was broken and I haven't maintained it, it does not have an airworthiness certificate by a current airworthiness certificate by the FAA and a mechanic.
Okay, I misunderstood you then. If they don't have the airworthiness certificate, they don't have to register it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, that is correct to the best of my understanding, that when an aircraft is not airworthy, in other words, it's in a state of repair, they don't have to register it because they cannot fly it.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? I close the hearing on 2068. Thank you very much. Okay. Can I apologize to him? I didn't ask you to. Next agenda item is Bruce Warner and Doug Tindall, and we're going to talk about. All going to join us too. Oh, good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me today, to my left and your right, is Doug Tindall, who is the administrator for the highway division of the department and has been in that position for just about a month. And next to him is Paul Mather, who is going to be talking to you about the subsequent agenda item on how we're using the OSU research study to help us make better decisions. And I might point out, I found out today is Mr. Mather's 20th year with the department. As of this day, Groundhog Day 20 years ago, I understand. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to do a quick overview, then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Tindall to give you some more specifics on the Oregon Transportation Investment Act program that we've been working on for the last few years. And what I wanted to do is again today, and I think was the request of the chair and the committee members, is to really give you an overview, including a list of the projects that we're actually working on in OTA 1, 2, and 3. I wanted to give you some maps of where these projects are located, and in fact, attached to my testimony, you should have a map that looks like this, which shows you the locations of the OTA 1, 2, and 3 projects. This is highways, modernization, preservation, and bridge. It does not include, I want to stress, the 170, I believe, number of local city and county bridges were also funded out of this program. So there is more dots that would go on this if you were looking at this local bridges. We also wanted to give you a quick update on where we are in living up to the commitments that to your budget note to essentially encourage the use of Oregon firms, Oregon workers, and increasing utilization of women and minorities in our work. And then really, Doug will also give you a quick update in terms of just the job creation as a result of this program, which I think was of greatest interest to the legislature. If you go on into my information, I just wanted to remind the committee, and for those of you who are new, the TIA 1 and 2 programs, which were created by the legislature in 2001 and then again in a special session in 2003, did provide $500 million worth of bonding authority supported by new revenues. And I wanted to stress to you, when you look at that map, there was another $162 million worth of local and private monies on top of that $500 million. So we did leverage additional dollars. So the total investment was almost $700 million from that initial $400 million investment done by the legislature in 2001. And what I also wanted to let you know is, and you'll hear some more about this, but the 36% of those OTIA 1 and 2 projects are already open to traffic. 37% of them are under construction as we speak. And the remaining 27% are in design, and it's our expectation, with very few exceptions, as I point out in my testimony, that most all of those projects will be open to traffic by 2008. If you go on to the second page of my testimony, just to give you a quick update on OTIA 3, I wanted to remind all of us that the legislature did make available to us $2.5 billion worth of revenues. You did specify that $1.6 billion of those monies were to be used to repair and replace bridges on the state system and on the city and county system that were important for freight. You also gave us the authorization for $500 million worth of modernization, and then did provide some monies to the cities and counties for ongoing maintenance and preservation. And I would also call your attention, there is a one-page summary of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act that I also included attached to my testimony, which is the piece that was prepared as the OTIA 3 was going through the legislature, as essentially a very quick summary of where the money comes from and goes to. I did want to let you know that in February of last year, the commission did adopt a list of city and county bridges to be funded out of the $300 million specified for those local bridges. We sold the bonds and within 2 days distributed the money to the cities and counties, and essentially have gotten out of their way, said it's your responsibility to deliver those bridges, and many of those bridges are under construction. I found out last night that some of them are even open to traffic, so the cities and counties are starting to deliver. There was a lot of discussion about operations and maintenance funds, the second bullet on the second page. I did want to remind you that the Oregon Department of Transportation did receive no money out of this OTIA 3 package for maintenance and preservation, but the cities and counties do have an ongoing source of revenue, and what we pointed out here is over the next 10 years, $361 million will be going to the cities and counties that they can use for maintenance and preservation of their systems, which, if you look at the 50-50 split of revenues that we new revenues have been generated for the Highway Trust Fund in recent history, that really is the equivalent of about 3 cents of gas tax with the truck weight mile fees that are dedicated to cities and counties for ongoing maintenance. And the next piece of it is we're talking about the bridges. We're going to hear a little bit more about that, but I did want to let you know that we are aggressively pursuing replacing the bridges on a state system. Right now there's 46 bridges under construction, 122 million dollars worth of dollar volume, and there's another 60 in design, and you're going to hear from Doug that there's many more that will be under design this year, and big packages of projects starting to come out this year. And then finally, I did want to note that we are utilizing our update of our state transportation improvement program, which we have a draft document prepared already, which would outline where those $500 million worth of modernization funds will go. I understand, Representative Hunt, you may have some questions about projects of statewide significance, and so what I'd like to do, maybe after Doug's done, I could give you a quick update on those, too. Finally, if you read on my testimony, I just want the committee to be aware that we are trying to do things differently in the department in terms of delivery of this program. We know that the legislature is expecting continual and ongoing reports about how we're doing and living up to our commitment to get the work out and seeing Oregonians employed. We're starting to do that. You also see that we're trying to do early involvement with many stakeholders, cities, counties, freight communities, so that we don't have every highway messed up for freight and movement of traffic. And we're doing some very aggressive things there, and maybe Mr. Mather can get into some of that. And then I think the bigger thing is that we are really shifting from an organization that used to do the majority of the design, project delivery in-house, and we're using a private sector in new and innovative ways. We're doing new sorts of contracting. Our Transportation Commission has been fully engaged all the way through this, and we're very, very pleased with support we've gotten. So in summary, what I think I wanted to convey to you before I pass it on to Doug is that the OTIA program is on track. It's on schedule. I think we're being faithful to the legislative direction. I think we're properly managing the program, and I think you're going to find out here when Doug gives you a presentation that essentially we are providing jobs and the economic impact to Oregon that you anticipated when you originally endorsed this program in 2001, 2002, and then finally in 2003. So if I could, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Tindall.
Listen first.
I may, please. Bruce, I just want to go back onto the money side of this thing again, just to make sure I understand this. $500 million for OTIA 1 and 2 and $2.5 billion for OTIA 3. Now, is all of that collectively bonded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, most of the revenue is bonded. There is portions of about $200 million of that last $500 million of the modernization of part of OTIA 3 is actually utilizing existing federal tools where we're essentially securing authorization to use federal dollars ahead of time. And if we do it properly, we can have up to $200 million of federal dollars available and roll them forward. So that's a piece of it. And what I didn't get into, and you can read there, and I think you had a question about that earlier, if you look at the rest of the revenues, most all of that is bonded, most of it with new revenues, but as you pointed out, a portion of the revenues to support those bonds do come up from existing sources, both our existing federal bridge program and about half of our share of the modernization monies that are required to be spent on modernization from the 4 cents of gas tax, which is our share, if I'm being responsive to your question.
Yeah, and I just want to repeat this again just to make sure that I understand this. It takes a couple times for these things to sink in with me, but the 4 cents is for modernization. Half of that goes to local governments, half goes to the state, so it's the half of that 2 cents, 1 cent that is dedicated to the debt service on the bonds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, very good. Yes, that is indeed the case.
I got it.
I'm going to ask you to repeat some. How much money is going to go to local counties and cities out of OTIA 3?
If you look at OTIA 3, what I just did on page, I guess, 2, it's the second bullet under OTIA 3, what I was just showing is over the next 10 years, as an example, there's $361 million that are going to cities and counties, and that split of that, I believe, is 60% to the counties, 40% to the cities. And that equates to about a $36.1 million a year a transfer of monies to the cities and counties. And that's ongoing. That's an ongoing source of revenue. So over those 10 years, they get that amount. And what I was saying is that's about the equivalent to their share of 3 cents of statewide gas tax with truck weight mile fees along with it, if I'm, again, answering your question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Further, yes.
Back on that, because I was wondering about that. But this is there under OTIA 3, but really it isn't OTIA 3, is it? The operation and maintenance to cities and counties. I mean, that's ongoing stuff that's always there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, it's not part of the bonded revenues, if that's what you mean, going to the repayment of the bonds for the bridges or modernization. This is money that is out of the new revenues that goes directly to the cities and counties. So it was part of the OTIA 3 funding package, but it's not part of the monies required to pay back any of the bonds.
And again, just one more question. Thank you. At the last presentation that you gave, I mentioned something about the bridge delivery group and being one more layer, and maybe somebody else will talk about this. But who is directly overseeing their work? Is it the department or is it the commission? You're watching it very closely, aren't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, yes, we are watching it very closely. And the Oregon Bridge Delivery Partners, which is the program management firm that we hired to manage the $1.3 billion worth of bridge replacement and repair program, the administrator of that program is my department. In fact, it's Mr. Tindall's program. It goes through a bridge delivery unit that reports directly to him. So his staff And Heather Catron, I think you may have met her, is the person who is ultimately responsible for managing that contract. And we'd be glad to give you some more information on that if you'd like.
Further questions? Okay, now, Doug.
Right. Chair Gilman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation in charge of the Highway Division. Director Warner has done a really good job framing up most of my testimony, so I'll skip over the introduction part and get into the meat of it. I want to talk a little bit about what Director Warner referred to as a shifting culture, I think. We have traditionally contracted out all of the construction work to private contractors. However, we've also done most of the design work, the environmental work, the right-of-way work internally within the department. OTIA 3 made us change that, and OTIA 3 and a budget note, in fact, made us change that model because we got a whole bunch more money and resulting in a whole bunch more work without any more staff. So the budget note directed us to hire a program, what we refer to as a program management firm, a firm to manage that program, the bridge delivery program in OTIA 3. And their purpose is to oversee, not do with what we would normally do with state staff, but to oversee that project to ensure that we get quick project delivery, that we have mobility throughout all of the construction that's going on. This is really an unprecedented level of construction forever, even during the big interstate years, that will impact traffic. And the reason I say that is because we're doing work on existing roads, whereas a lot of the interstate work was on new roads and therefore carried no impact to traffic. And also, the program management firm is charged with ensuring that we are employing and creating jobs in the private sector and doing so in a way that promotes a diverse workforce. So we're shifting from an organization that has traditionally done most work inside the department in terms of design and environmental. As when I started, probably 100% of the work was internal. As work grew and our resources declined or stayed stable, we got to a point where we were about probably 70 or 75% of the design and right-of-way work internally, and now we're moving to a model where we're doing about 30% of the design and right-of-way work internally, and the rest of it is going external. During this reorganization or shift from being a doing organization to being one that manages the whole system, these projects and the system, we shifted people out to our regional offices to get them closer to where the decisions are being made. So that's what used to be a large organization, largely headquartered in Salem, has now moved to being one that is distributed across the state to be in touch with the local needs. We've discussed this new direction with the legislature, has encouraged us in the past. The Transportation Commission has supported this. Representative Beyer, I guess I'd tell you, we're not just off on our own cooking up something new. We've vetted this with a number of people, and in fact, I think it's a necessary step in order to deliver the program that we've been charged to deliver. Talk about OTIA 1 and 2 a little bit, since this program or this presentation covers all of the OTIAs. It's sort of interesting if you look back to when OTIA 1 and 2 were passed. It was a huge deal, and now it's sort of been the expectation that we're going to deliver. And attached to my testimony is a list of projects that shows that we're living up to that expectation. We've completed 59 of the projects already, and we've got another 70 of the projects that are currently under construction, and only 43 of the original projects selected for OTIA 1 and 2 money remain to be contracted. They're in development. Development's going on, or design is going on, but they still have to be contracted. So three-quarters of the OTIA projects are already on, OTIA 1 and 2 projects are already on the way to being delivered in Oregon, and a good portion of them have already reached that. OTIA 3, which we all like to... It's, I did, attachment one.
Okay.
Sorry. I hope you got that. It was attachment one. It shows OTIA 1 and 2 status. If I didn't say that before, I meant to. OTIA 3, which is now the hot item because we're moving into it and the most recently funded, we've also started to complete projects on that list, too. We've already completed 46 bridge projects. I've said they are completed or they're underway to be completed. And if you look on attachment 2, that shows the progress on the state bridge projects. We're committed to maximizing the economic opportunities for Oregon firms and Oregon workers, and we're working with the contracting community to make sure that Oregon contractors can compete. This particular fact, along with the Oregon State Bridge study, which indicated we may have different options than we originally thought to repair bridges, and Paul will talk about that in a minute, caused us to step back a little bit and what we call rebundle, put projects in different sequences so that we can make sure that we're spending the money wisely and make sure that Oregon firms can compete. We're also doing a lot of this work with what's called design build. Our traditional model of work was that you would design the project, stop, and then bid the project. You can still do that with a consultant. The consultant can design the project, stop with a fixed point, and bid the construction out to a different firm. We're utilizing a technique called design build, where you bid the project once, and it is designed and built under the same contract. A more expeditious way of completing a project in many cases. And while we're doing this, we're not ignoring the environment in which we work. One of the big accomplishments in OBDP that the Bridge Delivery Partners have achieved is in the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area. We have a lot of work up there. We have to make sure that that work is done and results in a project that conforms to the Columbia River and is well suited to the environment. And I was told that at the first meeting they had, the first public outreach meeting they had, to talk about how the OTIA 3 bridge delivery would be performed in the Columbia Gorge area. The meeting ended up, a public meeting up in Troutdale, ended up with applause at the end, which is not always typical for public meetings. In fact, maybe unheard of before now. The next piece of my written testimony talks about the five delivery stages. I'm going to defer that and let Paul talk about the five stages. And I have attached to my testimony is the map that looks like this, that shows those five stages that we're doing. I want to point out that we picked these five stages as being the major routes to ensure freight connectivity in Oregon. This is not all of the places that freight goes, and these five stages do not address all of the bridge problems that we have across the state. Paul will give you a little bit more on that. Let me turn to job creation. Clearly, one of the key factors in the legislature and key direction that we got heard from the legislature in passing this bill was we wanted to create jobs in addition to keep freight moving. And attached to my testimony, I believe, is attachment 4, is a graph that shows the jobs that will be created or sustained as a result of OTIA 3 and the STIP. I want to be clear that that is not just OTIA 3. That is the entire program. But this is just a graphical expression of how many jobs are created when you are doing road work and road construction. And also I want to point out that these job numbers include the city and county highway projects, but not the maintenance and operation portion, either the part that was in OTIA 3 or the ongoing portion that we both have, both cities and counties and the state. What we're trying to show, I guess, with this is something that we haven't really talked about before. We talk about transportation and the benefits of transportation funding in the terms of providing transportation. But clearly you can see from this there's an ancillary benefit besides just providing transportation that you are providing jobs for the community. And in providing those jobs, we try to do that or working towards doing that in a manner that encourages all people to be able to be in the workforce and providing those jobs. There's a list of actions that we're taking to ensure that we have a diverse workforce. I'm going to highlight just a couple. We're developing new diversity performance standards that we expect to be achieved. We're setting performance standards for design and construction contracts, as well as just integrating these into our ongoing process, and we're working with community colleges and other state agencies to determine training requirements and make sure that we're building a process where we can have a workforce in an ongoing way that there's a tap to be or a resource to be tapped, in the future, that we have a diverse workforce and that we're providing jobs for all Oregonians. So I'll close by saying that we are on track. I was just looking to see if I was going to close with something else, if Bruce was writing me a note. I guess he is. No, I'll close with we're on track with OTIA 1, 2, and 3. Bruce just referred to OTIA 1 and 2 projects being substantially completed by 2008. Really, in terms of where the Department of Transportation was in the 90s to ramp up from the time OTIA 1 and 2 were passed, to ramp up and complete those jobs that quickly is something I think you should note. That is not something that I think we would have been expected to be able to do 10 years ago, but we can do it now. The OTIA program management firm was selected and is on board, and again, Representative Beyer is the program management firm is overseen by my staff directly, and they're just there to, as an extension of ODOT staff, to work to get contracts out. They're not on their own. They're not just running loose out there. We have a very specific contract and very specific expectations. And Director Warner and I have met with their principals to make sure that we're communicating what our expectations are for that firm.
Thank you.
The Highway Division realignment is complete, and I believe it positions us to deliver these projects, OTIA 1, 2, and 3, and positions us to deliver whatever you ask us to do and whatever you provide funding for in the future. This model is a solid model that gets the decision-making close to the people, close to the places that we can ensure that we're delivering projects that people want. And the funding that you've provided, we take credit for creating jobs, but really it's the funding that you all provided that's turned into that job creation for Oregon. So I look at this as a success to this date, and I hope it builds a foundation for future opportunities to improve the transportation system in Oregon, to employ Oregon firms. And I appreciate the chance to be here today. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Regional Manager for Southwest Oregon for ODOT. I also have the added responsibility of providing leadership for our bridge program, what we call the Bridge Options Report, which was created for the prior legislative session that was the foundation for the OTIA 3 bridge program, and have continued to kind of shepherd the bridge program through, even as we've hired the program management firm to take over the actual delivery, but continue to function in a leadership role. What I want to do today is talk to you a little bit background around the program, bring you up to speed on some of the things that have happened since the last legislative session, most notably our study that we asked Oregon State to conduct for us, and the results of those study, and what we're doing with those studies to ensure that we're bringing the best value for the dollars in the OTIA 3 bridge program. If I can have the... There we go. Just want to start by turning the clock back a little bit to 2 years ago in legislative session. The Bridge Options Report that I referred to is really the document that we use to document the impact that restricted highways, restricted bridges would have on Oregon's economy and on its communities. We talked on the economic standpoint, we talked about 88,000 jobs being lost to Oregon's economy between now and 2025 and a total of $123 billion impact to Oregon's economy. We talked about impact to Oregon's communities where we had to divert heavy truck traffic off of Interstate 5, off of Interstate 84 through communities and the impacts that would have on schools, neighborhoods, downtowns. What we identified in the study is routes throughout the state that we could secure for 20 years. As Doug was talking about, these aren't the only freight routes we have in the state. There may not be even the highest priority freight routes we have in the state, but for the dollar we could invest in the bridge problems on a given route, from a cost-benefit standpoint, from input we had from industries, and from stakeholders, we created this strategic pattern of routes throughout the state. Another thing we identified in the report was really a shift in our thinking of how to fund bridges. Prior to this, we would fund bridges on a list from worst to first. And so you'd rank the bridges that need to be repaired, 1 through 100, and you'd start at the top and see how far your funding got, and those are the bridges that got funded. Often what that left you is still the same routes restricted. You may have kind of hopscotched around the state to different routes and fixed one bridge or another bridge, but the route from point A to point B ended up still being restricted because there was another bridge that fell below the funding line that was not repaired. So again, in a more strategic way, in a more holistic way, look from a corridor standpoint and prioritize your bridge needs to ensure we had those routes available for freight and the economic needs of the state. Talk a little bit about the staging. The map there on the slide is the same map that Doug was referring to earlier. I'll just quickly just kind of run through what our strategy and what our thinking was as we put the five stages together. As you look at the blue stage there, kind of in the center of the map, it's the Highway 97 through Central Oregon, Highway 26 over Mount Hood, and Highway 20 from Bend, Ontario was really where we started the program. Even though our priority is the interstate system, it's the backbone for freight, it's the backbone for the economy of the state, we really needed a route that we could start on that was less intense work that we're going to see on the interstate and could provide that north-south, east-west connection from Portland to our neighboring states, our neighboring economies, to ensure that in a relatively short order we could get that up and running to keep freight moving in the state. So that's where we started. And we also need Stage 1 to serve as an alternative route, so when we do start work on the interstate in a very intense fashion, we have a place for over-width, over-dimension, overweight traffic to use that route as we have potential restrictions through construction zones on the interstate. So Stage 1 starts through Central Oregon. It's largely under construction today. Many of the bridge numbers that you see us talk about are on Stage 1 as we've started our priority there. Stage 2, we turn it to the interstate. Stage 2 includes all of I-84, includes the northern portion of I-5 from Eugene to Portland, also includes Highway 58. Stage 3 is the balance of I-5 through Southern Oregon. This is where the most intensive bridge work that we have in the entire program and really needed Stage 1 and 2 in place really to tolerate the amount of work that's going to be happening in this corridor. Once we have the backbone of the interstate done, we're able to then build key freight routes from the interstate to coastal communities and ports and also throughout eastern Oregon. And so in Stage 4 there in the yellow, those are routes that begin to do that. In the Stage 5 in the green, they do the same thing and function the same way, but as we start to maximize the amount of dollars we have available, the green routes don't quite provide the same level of truck traffic on them as the four previous stages do. The four previous stages accommodate what we call weight table 5, or essentially any load. So if you need to move a yarder, a transformer, any of those kind of things, you're able to move on the Stage 1 through 4 routes. The Stage 5 routes are only good for the 105,000 pound loads, but accommodate about 98% of the traffic that we see out there. But for a significantly less amount of dollars, we're able to cover and connect much more of Oregon there in stage five. So turning directly to the Oregon State Study, again, we're back 2 years ago. We're putting together the Bridge Options Report, understanding the impacts of Oregon's economy and to its communities. We're also, as a department, need to understand more about these bridges, the particular bridge design that happened throughout the 50s that we're living with, and beginning to understand more of its limitations and its lifespan. We needed to understand more about that. As we managed through the reconstruction of those bridges and the inventory of bridges we were still going to have left even after the five stages were complete. So we asked Oregon State to perform a study for us to determine if there is more capacity in there than the national models that we were using at the time were telling us. Because in the field, those of us out there looking at these bridges, some of the information we were getting out of the national models in some cases said the bridge shouldn't be able to stand up under its own weight, yet we were seeing traffic use those bridges. So we needed to understand more about that, and we need to understand how much life is left in these bridges. Probably the most important piece from a public safety standpoint was what were the failure mechanisms of these bridges? When they do fail, what's that going to look like? Is it going to be a catastrophic failure, or are we going to be able to know when that bridge fails over time? So for 2 years, Oregon State did perform their study. They looked at four bridges that are on our system. They also had 40-some bridges, bridge beams they created in their laboratory and broke in different ways and different fashions and measured those to begin to understand this particular bridge beam design. They confirmed these bridges are failing, in many cases have failed. They also confirmed, though, there is a little more strength. There is more strength in these beams than what the national model would predict, and they prescribed some different ways for us to measure and some different ways to, for us to make those calculations to determine exactly how much strength is left in these beams. Probably most importantly, they found that these bridges will not fail catastrophically, that they'll be given adequate warning to us as they begin to move into their mode of failure. And finally, there is still some work between the study and actual implementation. We're just coming up on being able to actually have a calibrated model that we can actually go out and use on these bridges and then have that automated by September 05. So you can see here on the next slide, as we begin to implement those things, those are some of the key dates that we see out there. But this new technology, it is actually new technology that hasn't existed not only in Oregon but throughout the nation, that we're going to be able to utilize and make some better decisions, not only in the OTIA 3 bridge program, but just in managing the bridges that we have left on our system. The Oregon State Study is only one piece of data that we've gathered during the last 2 years. We've also done what we call baseline reports. We've gone out and actually looked at all the bridges in the OTIA 3 program. That's 365 bridges. We've actually gone out and performed detailed study from an engineering standpoint and from an environmental standpoint so we could start the permitting processes on these bridges. And through that effort, we've gained a lot more information than we had available in our files prior to that. We inspect our bridges on our two-year cycles. So we have a new round of inspection reports available to us and just more experience in dealing with these kind of bridges over the last couple of years. Based on all that information, we've been over the last couple of months going back through and reviewing stages 2 through 5. As I said before, stage 1 is under construction, all the bridges in stage 1. That represents about 10% of the program. So about 90% of the program we're able to go back and apply this new information to. As we go back and take the baseline reports, take the Oregon State Study for what we know of it and the other information we've gathered, we kind of go through this decision-making tree that I have on here. In some cases, we're able to say from the baseline reports or the Oregon State Study that there's actually, instead of repair work needed on this bridge, there's actually no work needed on this bridge. And there's, I believe, 10 or 15 that we've come across so far that fall into that category. In some cases, going through, again, the baseline reports and working with the communities, the bridge is actually cross roads that have been abandoned, railroad lines that have been abandoned, so there's not a reason for the bridge to be there any longer. So rather than repairing the bridge or replacing the bridge, it's just removal of the bridge. In a lot of cases, we have a bridge that we had scheduled for replacement that now we can do repairs on. And so at somewhat less than 50% of the cost in most cases. We're able to do repairs and still meet our objective of a 20-year life for that bridge and secure that corridor for 20 years and save those dollars. In some cases, we still need to do the replacement. There's other elements of the bridge that are in need to be replaced, the foundation of the bridge, the columns in the bridge. There's other things that are driving the structural condition of the bridge. There's safety issues, whether it's a height restriction or a site distance restriction. The bridge may be key to some of our STIP projects or some of our OTIA 1 or 2 projects that we already have in our program. The key assumption was this bridge would be replaced to either reduce a restriction or put a roadway on a new alignment. In some cases, especially on the interstate, we have parallel structures. One bridge was built 4 or 5 years ahead of the other bridge, has different deterioration rates on its members, and we need to replace that bridge. The one right next to it, we can do repairs on, but when we start thinking our way through that and mobilizing a contractor out there, building a detour bridge for traffic and so forth, it actually makes sense to go ahead and replace both bridges at the same time. One project we just went out with a design build contract on a couple months ago, we actually asked that question in the bidding process and confirmed that for a relatively low cost, we were able to replace both bridges rather than repairing the one. There's still a whole group of bridges that we're not able to come to conclusion on at this point. We still need to have that calibrated model fully functional for us to make those determinations on repair, replace, and so they've fallen into the more analysis needed. And as that model becomes more functional for us, we'll be able to make those determinations. Our challenge through this has really been able to keep the momentum of this program moving forward. We have the construction and the consulting communities mobilized to move this program forward, and we need to keep that momentum going. So as we're able to land definitively on a scope, whether it's repair or replace, we've tried to move those through the assembly line and moving those on into construction to keep the job creation and the other goals of this program moving forward. As we look so far, we've gotten through stages 2 and 3 of the program. Roughly half the bridges in those stages look like they're going to change scope, in most cases downward scope, so from a replaced to a repair scope. But again, as we have certainty on those, we move them forward through to keep the momentum of the program moving forward. In summary, we're going to bring the conclusions that we have in stages 2 through 5 as we review these bridges to an updated bridge options report. I referred to the bridge options report that we created for the last legislative session. By early spring, we hope to have an updated version that has updated cost estimates and updated scope for each one of the bridges that we're able to present to you as we've gone through this different review. And we continue to move the program forward. As you've heard in all our testimonies, we have aggressive schedules with these bridges. We have 2 OTIA 3 bridges that are now open to traffic, 46 that are under construction. That dollar amount represents about 10% of the program that we have out there, so about 10% is under construction. And then 60 more are still in design. So with that, concludes my testimony and take any questions.
Questions?
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
Representative Thatcher.
You stated that about 10 to 15 of the bridges now require no work where work was planned, and up to half of the bridges are probably going to be downgraded in scope of repair. And OTIA was, I think, approved because it looked like the sky was falling. I mean, you know, the bridges were falling, literally, and I'm glad they're not necessarily in some cases, but what is the savings planned for? I mean, it sounds like there will be savings. What do you plan on doing with it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, first I'd start my response remembering back to the original bridge options report where we identified $4.7 billion worth of bridge problems. This represented 1.3 of the state bridges that needed to be addressed. So we still have bridge work needed out there even beyond what this is. There's critical highways, freight routes that we've designated. The industry has come forward to that we weren't able to get to in the original OTIA 3 bridge list. My plans would be wanting to do more bridge work as I try to implement this. But as we go through and have the updated bridge options report, will give you better clarity on how much money are we actually talking about that may be available for other needs, whether it's bridge needs or other transportation needs. Really, my recommendations, what we're going to recommend in the report, is we're still very early on in an 8 to 10 year program. We still have a lot of information out there to gather on how these bridges are actually going to come in versus their estimate into construction. We see steel prices go up, concrete prices go up. To say we have savings at this point very early on is really premature. Our recommendation is once Stage 2 is fully in construction, Stage 3 is fully designed, and we start getting those into bid, that's about 2 years from now. That's the point where we would have much more confidence to say where this program is going to land financially and start to be able to make commitments to where else those dollars could be spent.
Thank you.
Yes.
And I want to start out by thanking you for doing this. I wasn't here last session, but I kind of watched it go along, and it's really amazing to see what's come about in the 2 years. So, and then the second one, there's a bit of a glitch in Seaside's project, one of their OTA projects. And if you could just speak to what happens if this, what it is there's a project that is one of the projects partially Seaside, partially Tillamook County, so it's all in my district, and the Seaside piece is a modernization, or is that where it falls under? Right through town, and then the other piece is down in Tillamook, but with the Seaside being done first, Tillamook's depending on that because they're not quite ready to go yet. And I know there's time frame and all that, but what has happened in short is it will be an initiative on the ballot, and I'm not sure when that is going to be. I apologize for not knowing what's happening in my own town, but it's been in the papers on and off, and the judge, it went to the court and everything, and they finally ruled that they could have the election, and it will then determine whether we don't know yet whether the project is going to be approved as proposed or if it's something different. There's some confusion about what's happening. So, Director Werner, could you speak to that, please? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, I'd be glad to. I think you should also know that I met with about 13 people from the city of Seaside yesterday, including the mayor and a number of the council members, so I think I can give you a pretty good update. You're correct. The courts did determine that the action of the city council entering into an IGA wasn't something that could be referred to the voters, which actually concerns me, but again, the ballot titles are being finalized, the statements are being finalized. I think they may be finalized today. My understanding is that it is a May election where the voters will essentially say yes, the city should have gone forward with an intergovernmental agreement with us to move forward the project as is, or no, they don't think that they wanted to do that. And the project, as you know, we're moving all, this is an OTIA 1 project, and our commitment was, again, to get the money out into the economy as quickly as possible, put it on projects that are ready to go. The folks that I met with believe that the vote will be positive in support of the project, but again, from our perspective, we have a number of things to do to prepare right-of-way maps and prepare for the project. That work will be done in a couple months. We are then essentially suspend work until the election is held, and if the election is essentially a yes vote, we'll move right into acquiring the right-of-way and moving the project forward as planned. If it's a no vote, quite frankly, then as far as we can see, that project as envisioned and worked with the community for the last 2.5 years is probably dead, and we need to start over with another project, and we need to figure out plan B, where that money would essentially go, and we probably looking at putting on one of the other projects that are more ready to go, and then obviously have a dialogue in future updates of our state transportation improvement program about funding that project. So my desire and hope is that the city is able to move forward to the project where I thought we spent almost $5 million getting to the project to the level it is right now. And so I think the community feels very good about it, and so do we. So at least the ones that I talked to yesterday.
Okay.
Yes, certainly.
And so how would that affect the project on board for Tillamook?
The one of the discussions, we are thinking about what projects we have ready to go so that we can live up to the commitment to the legislature if that project is not successful at the election. We will also engage the Area Commission on Transportation, and the chair of that commission was also in the meeting yesterday, and they are going to start having some dialogues to also give us some advice about what other project may be funded, because they would obviously like to see those funds stay in that particular area.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes.
First, I would say I really appreciate bringing forward the whole OSU study. When the analysis process from OSU surfaced, you must have had some sense of fear and trepidation that if you brought it forward, then we would start attacking you for some kind of, you know, bait and switch. So I really commend you for bringing it forward, because obviously the outcome is going to be we're going to get these projects done still on the same timeline for a lot less cost. So I applaud you for taking that risk and doing the right thing in terms of taxpayers' dollars. Following up on Representative Thatcher's question, just to crystallize a little more in my mind, have there been any decisions made either within the department or by the commission, or is there any decision process that is beginning that would commit any of those savings, whatever they are, from this to anything else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hutt, we've had just about the level of discussion you've had here. Essentially, we know that there may be some savings, and I think what you heard is, I think it is premature to talk about the savings until we see where we are and anything that may change. And again, price of steel was one of those, an example, and I know Representative Thatcher understands the impact that can have on products out there. So we believe in another couple of years we'll have a good thought about it. Is there savings, first off? And then I made it clear to, I think, another committee who asked me the same question. The legislative intent and direction was clear. You wanted these bridges that are on stages 1 through 5 repaired, replaced, to be able to handle the legal truckloads. If we can accomplish that for less money, then we need to come back and have a dialogue with you about how best to spend those monies. And we will probably have a recommendation on how we ought to be spending those. But again, we expect that ultimately the legislature is going to give us some direction in terms of the type of use of those money as you would desire.
Other questions? Thank you. John, you had a question.
Could you tell me what in terms of the $1.3 billion program that's being managed by this firm, what percentage of that money is going to them for what might be referred to as management fees, not directly related to design and construction work?
Chair Gilman, Mr. Hauser, I'm not sure of the exact dollar amount that is it's. I'm not sure if you're asking about the fee for program management. I believe that's on the order of $70 or $80 million, but I can confirm that for you. So that it's in that kind of context is how much they are being paid to manage it for us.
Okay. And do you have another one?
John's question, actually, I had it written down right in front of me, but I forgot my second question, which was actually related to one John just raised. You talked about the major shift of having the overwhelming percentage being designed in-house to the change where the overwhelming percentage are outsourced. Do you have some performance measures that you're utilizing to basically look at that and to see if, in fact, maybe we should shift even a greater percentage out, or if maybe the pendulum was swung too far and it would be more effective financially or in terms of projects to have a greater percentage back in? Do you have some measurements as you're looking at these, both the ones you're still doing in and the ones that you have out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hutt, really good question. We are monitoring closely. We have benchmarks, performance measures we know of in terms of what it costs, for example, for us to do projects in terms of general administration, preliminary engineering, construction engineering, all of the various pieces of that. And we keep track of that for every one of our projects, for every one of our regions, so we know how we're doing so we can benchmark our work. We are, again, embarking, as you hear, on a new way of doing business, but we'll be tracking those costs costs the same way, because there's a great deal of interest, as you would imagine, both from the private sector side and from my employees' standpoint, in terms of making sure that we are getting the best bargain. There are some huge economies of scale on a $1.3 billion project. So it's our expectation when we get done, we should see a better performance in terms of what it would take on, when you aggregate smaller projects throughout the, let's say a decade's worth of experience. We believe, we hope that that will show that we actually are able to beat some of our old performance expectations in those areas, just because of the magnitude and the way we're moving this forward and to get it out as quickly as possible, because I think, as you know, time is money in many of these projects. So we'll be able to report to you on a regular basis. If you want to start getting some of that, we'll be glad to provide some of that information. But that's something we track very, very carefully.
Paul, I believe it was you that on the summary on the last page on this, you said two bridges completed, 47 under construction, and then you said that represents 10% of the cost so far, so the total cost.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, the cost that we have into construction is about $122 million. That's roughly 10% of the 1.3 that we're talking about. So just it represents about 10% of the $1.3 billion program is committed to construction, was my point.
Okay, for all the bridges?
For all the OTF3 bridges.
Okay, right. All right. Thank you. I missed that. Yep. Thanks.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Anything further to come before the... Oh, statewide significance.
Yes, thank you.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, if I could, what you should have in front of you, I believe, is a sheet of paper that lists what are an adopted list by our Oregon Transportation Commission of projects that they consider of statewide importance. And this does not include all of them, I want to assure you, but these are the ones that they have picked that are usually in excess of about $100 million each. Some of them, the price tags may start with B's. But this is the list that the commission has said, we want you to start moving with our stakeholders to start moving these projects forward towards construction because of their importance to Oregon. And what I wanted to let you know, and I can tell you very quickly on these projects, you see there's a number of them. Projects like the I-5 Columbia River Crossing. I think anybody who's driven I-5 in the morning or afternoons know there's a problem in the I-5 corridor. We have an agreement with the state of Washington to work on a cooperative project. OTIA 3 monies we're recommending be allocated to this project. We're also working with the two congressional delegations on both sides of the river. Both governors, as you know, are talking about this. This is a project where the construction does end in B's, and it's more than just a highway project. It's a highway transit, transportation demand management, heavy rails in this corridor. There's lots of things that need to be done to realize the improvements in this corridor. So this is an example of one. Sunrise Corridor, Representative Hunt, probably one you're very interested in, is one which, as you know, we are moving forward with an environmental effort with Clackamas County and the region, and OTIA 3 monies are also recommended to be moved forward on this project to essentially ready it for construction. And this is also a project that we're actually now are asking the private sector if they'd like to take advantage of our public-private partnership program that the legislature gave us a couple sessions ago, to see if the private sector can come up ways to help not only design and build it, but fund design and build this project. So that's one that's moving along. I think the next big one down that I would point to is Highway 20, Pioneer Mountain to Eddyville. That's a project that we're recommending significant amounts of the OTIA $3 to go to, because it will be ready to go. We actually have a proposal on the street right now for a design build contract to construct this project, which we estimate is probably about a $130 million project, which we hope to have under contract earlier or later this spring. And then the Newburgh-Dundee Transportation Project is another one, which I think anybody who's driven through Newburgh or Dundee on a Friday afternoon or a weekend understands that problem. This is a $350 million project. We will have some OTIA monies allocated to this project, and this is another project that we'll be seeking input from the private sector to see if they're interested in funding the entire project or portions of the project. So this is an example, a snapshot of many of the projects. And if you want specific information on any individual project, we'd be glad to come talk to any of you about them, because it would take more than you know, 2 minutes here to talk about these individual projects. But these are projects that we are aggressively moving forward with the limited funds we have available. As you can see, at least one of them is ready for construction, but others we're still working, getting through the environmental and land use hoops to be able to move them towards construction. And we think there's some exciting funding options that may be available for these above and beyond the normal state transportation funding like we've done in the past. So that would be a quick snapshot, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Hutt. If you have other questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Any more questions? And maybe one thing that might be helpful, even just to get for all of us, just you start to list a couple of figures, but just to list the total project projected for each one, and then how much has already been identified from state, local, a couple of cases, federal sources.
Right.
That might give us a glimpse of where the totals are and where pretty significant gaps are. I guess the one question I would have beyond that is, do you anticipate bringing forward anything this session as a department in terms of beyond the public-private partnerships, any funding recommendations related to these this session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hutt, the recommended state from the governor's transportation program is Connect Oregon. There is some connections for other modes of transportation, for example, in the I-5 corridor. So if that becomes a reality and the legislature moves forward with that, there may be pieces of the I-5 Columbia River crossing that could be funded by that funding source. But there are no other highway-related transportation funding that we as a department or state is proposing at this time.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good.
Transportation Committee is adjourned.